I expect to be done the book of Acts maybe next week. So I know that we're in chapter 27 today, and we're gonna zip through 27, 28. The reality, though, is the last two chapters are very, very much narrative. They're simply telling the story. And I will do a little bit of recap at the end of the study just to remind us of where we've been for the last, year and a bit. But since it has always been our custom that when we come to the end of one study, that I get a sense of where you are and what you would like to study in future times. And I have done this for all the years that I've taught Sunday school. And ironically enough, I was calculating, I think I've missed 1 year out of the last 30 in teaching Sunday school. I've never not taught it. I mean, right from almost the day I got saved, for some strange reason, God had me in a position of teaching. So anyways, I have always made this my tradition. And maybe traditions are bad and traditions can be changed, but I have often found that by simply putting out a little bit of a survey and finding out where the class is at, that there tends to be some kind of a unity. Well, I mean, not complete unity, but some kind of sense of unity in terms of where we go from here. So I'm not going to try to put any bugs in your ears. What I am going to do, though, is I'm going to hand out a piece of paper to you. The piece of paper is really simple. You don't have to sign it or anything. You just said, for the next Bible Study Plus, I'd be interested in studying the following. And I can't promise you that I'll do everybody's, because obviously we do have divergent thoughts on this. But I have been praying that the Spirit would give us some wisdom and leadership and direction. So maybe you'd like a book of the Bible. You would just check off book of the Bible and then write the book in. Don't check off book of the Bible and leave nothing blank, because I might do Habakkuk or something. And you go, what's... It is a very good one, actually.
That last little thing.
Yeah, it's a great book. It's all about the questions that we ask sometimes of why God. Yeah,
it's a great book.
It is. It's just ironic that you say that, because most people say, what's the world happening? Maybe you don't want to study a book of the Bible. Maybe you'd like to study a particular subject. And you can write in anything there, as long as it relates to Christendom somehow, way, shape, or form. But jot that in. And I'm not limiting this to one per person. I made up about 25 of these. If you'd like to put multiple in or just write multiple down here, that's fine. And I'm just going to collate them over the next week and pray through and just get a sense of where God would have us to go. So to that end, I'm just going to ask you to maybe grab one, two, pass them along, and we'll circulate them. And then let's see where the Spirit would have us to go. While that's going around, and you can hand those in to me this week, next week, if maybe you get an idea in the middle of the week, email me, that's fine. I'm good no matter what. But I would invite you to turn with me to Acts chapter 27. I know it's been a couple of weeks since we've looked here, so let me just again reiterate where Paul is. He has been in jail in Caesarea for the last, do you remember how many years? This is while he's still in Israel. So if you remember, he was taken by the Jews. The Romans saved him. He then went and sat for a long time with Felix and then Festus. And then he's just had his little time with Agrippa and Bernice. For Festus and Felix, he was in jail there for, 2 years. So he's already been in jail for 2 years. And at the end of it, if you remember, he says, I appeal to Caesar, which was his Roman right. It gave him the ability to say, hey, I don't think the trial here is fair. I'm going to appeal all the way up to the top. Now, the woe to that was if you lost your appeal to Caesar, there was nowhere else to go. So it was likely you would end up dying. But Paul just didn't see any other way. And in the process, God had appeared to him. Christ has said, Paul, you will minister in my name in Rome. You're going to get there, Paul. And so, as I've mentioned here, he's got this dream to come to Rome. In fact, in Romans chapter 1, verse 13, if you remember all the way back when Pastor John started that, it was his passion. I want to go to Rome. He'd never visited Rome before. And then we talked about this question, does God sometimes fulfill our dreams in ways we do not expect? Paul probably didn't want to go to Rome via 2 years of jail, but he did. Chapter 27 and chapters 28 basically describe Paul's journey from Israel to Rome. So the question for you, and I know most of you have read this at some point in time because you know, we've gone through the book of Acts. Why do you think Luke spends two chapters out of his book on this subject? Right? Remember, Luke will spend like three or four verses to say Paul went to Berea, Paul went to Thessalonica, Paul went to Corinth. But now all of a sudden we got two chapters almost of his journey to Rome. Now, I know that when we read Bible, we don't typically think of questions like this, but I would encourage you to, why do you think he spends so much time on this? Yeah, I think there's at least a portion of that where we should say to ourselves, okay, Paul has been led by the Spirit. He's done all these right things. And now all of a sudden, he's taking this tremendous, difficult journey in which it seems like everything is against him. And that's how it's going to seem, and I'll show you what I mean in a couple of minutes. But everything is against him, and yet God finds the way, if you will, in a sense, to get him from where he is to where he's supposed to be. But it's not in a way that Paul would have wanted. And it's not in a way that's really easy to discern, to see the hand of God. Now, you're going to see the hand of God in these two chapters. Don't get me wrong. But a cursory reading, if you were just to read it, Paul has to go from here to here. He has to fight against the storms. He's going to be shipwrecked. He's going to have a snake bite. He's going to have all these bad things happen to them. If you read it in that sense, you get this idea that, well, where is God in all of this? Not unlike the book of Esther. I don't know if you know this, but the book of Esther is the only book of the entire Bible that never mentions this one thing. Any idea what it is? God. Book of Esther never mentions God. And yet it's clear that God is all the way through the book of Esther, all the way from the beauty pageant to the fact that Esther would save her people. I would just like to throw this out to you today that I think that there are some parallels here between Esther and the book here, or the last part of this book of Acts, in which you very seldom see God work overtly, but he's working. Do we know that he could snap his finger and calm the storm? Sure, he's done it with, Jesus has done it multiple times. But this storm is going to rage for 2 weeks. I want you to see the hand of God in 2019. Sometimes it's going to work in very overt ways. You're just going to be, oh my goodness, look at what God has just done. It's remarkable. And sometimes he's going to be working in such subtle ways. You're going to say, where is he? And I don't ever want you to lose hope of the fact that he's still there. And I think that's at least in part why Luke is spending a lot of time here developing this portion of the story. Any other thoughts that maybe have come to your mind in terms of why? What should be the encouragement that we walk away with in this? And again, maybe some of you haven't read this yet, so it's not a fair question because we're sort of thinking about the future. But any other thought? We can hold off and come back to it. It's okay.
Well, it seems to me that trip to Rome.
So it's interesting that though there's a Christian church at Rome, Paul's influence when he gets there is going to be substantial. And as you probably are aware, that the first three centuries, Rome would actually become the epicenter for Christendom. Right? So the Roman Catholic Church, of course, has its roots born right here. Now, by the 3rd, 4th, and 5th century, what ends up happening is Christendom breaks in a sense, both to Rome and to Constantinople, which is in the east. And two epicenters of Christianity will arise. And it will not be until 1054 AD that they actually separate and form what will become the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church. But it is interesting how important this place is in terms of how God will develop the Christian church throughout the centuries. So there certainly can be said of that too, this concept of pushing forward towards what God has laid in our hearts, not maybe fully understanding its value yet, but trusting that its value is going to be huge. We'll throw those out and get you to think about that as we move through this chapter. But I do want just to encourage you that when you're reading Scripture, I want you to think about why the Spirit of God has motivated the authors to write what they have. I'm old-fashioned enough to believe in what's called the verbal plenary inspiration of Scripture, which means that I believe that in the original autographs, when the original authors wrote their manuscripts, that it was exactly what God wanted them to speak. It was authoritative, it was truth, capital T truth, and it was exactly what God wanted. And I think that it has served us well ever since. So, there are reasons here. Let's look at this. When it was decided, chapter 27, verse 1, that we would sail for Italy, Paul and some other prisoners were handed over to a centurion named Julius. He belonged to the Imperial Regiment. The Imperial Regiment, your translations will have slightly different terminologies here, but basically it just meant it was the court guard of Augusta, of the emperor. So this was a very high-ranking Roman official that was watching over these people. So we boarded a ship for the Adramidium, about to sail for ports along the coast of the province of Asia, we put out to sea. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was with us. Now, in the book of Acts, I have oftentimes mentioned the us passages. Who is the us? Luke, right? So Luke is again identifying the fact that he's on this trip. So that's important for us to know, because you should ask yourself this question right off the bat. We've got this Aristarchus, could be one of a number of characters in the New Testament by that name, and we've got Luke. How is it that Aristarchus and Luke can travel with Paul? Paul's a prisoner. Typically, prisoners don't get the option to say, hey, yeah, well, I'm on my way to Rome, so I'm going to take you, 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 and you. We don't know for sure, but we do know that by the second century, one of our second century historians, Pliny by his name, writes that it was allowable to bring your slaves with you on such a journey if you were to be transported for a possible trial in Rome. So we don't have any concept of this in the first century. It's not written down, but it's possible. So if that's true, then what Luke and Aristarchus has decided to do is they would identify themselves as Paul's slaves so that they might travel with him, which is a pretty remarkable thing when you think about it. Nobody wants to be identified as a slave, and yet they are so desiring to walk with their, in essence, their father in Christ, their spiritual head, that they are willing to lower themselves. Say, we're slaves. And we're going to serve our master, Paul. And so please bring us along on this journey. And because perhaps that Rome, Paul was a Roman citizen, they allowed this. But I would just encourage you, maybe just to think about it, and maybe you never got this out of the passage before, but how far am I willing to go to serve my brothers and sisters? Here, Luke and Aristarchus are willing to go on this very dangerous journey. Because quite frankly, if they traveled as his slaves, I don't know what would happen to them if Paul were killed. They might be killed too. You get that picture, right? These people were willing to serve Paul to the nth degree. I think I've got a map coming up here. Maybe I'm lying. If I didn't, that was dumb on my part. No, we'll come back to the map in a minute. It must be coming. Sorry. Let me just zip forward here. So on the next day, we landed at Sidon, and Julius, in kindness to Paul, allowed him to go to his friends so they might provide for his needs. Now, I really need to do a map. I'm going to go backwards here just a little bit. Forgive me. I know I got one somewhere there, but I got to have one somewhere back here. Come on. Heck, how far back does human government go? Boy, we talked a lot about government. No. Arg.
Looking for a pirate map?
What's that?
Looking for a pirate map?
Pirate map. Very piratey, arg. There it is. How come I missed that? I just would have gone forward. Okay, so let's talk about this, because I think this is important just for us to get this layout. I call this his fourth missionary journey, even though it may be not. So he's starting down here in Caesarea. This is where he spent the last 2 years in jail, right? So he got captured here in Jerusalem. If you remember last time we talked, they drove him up here with some horses to Caesarea. So Felix, Festus, Agrippa all happened here. And now he's going to make this trip all the way up to Rome because he's appealed to Caesar. So this first 67 miles here of this journey. So again, verse 2. And we boarded a ship from the Adramidium, about to sail for ports along the coast of the province of Asia. We put out to sea. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was with us. The next day we landed at Sidon. And Julius, in kindness to Paul, allowed him to go to his friend so they might provide for his needs. So about 67 miles. I'm going to get a little bit technical, if that's okay with you. I'm not a person who knows a lot about nautical systems. I know a little bit. And it's important for you to know prevailing winds, of course, are from the west. In order for Paul to make this journey in a day, that tells us that the winds at that point in time were likely south to southwest. So they were blowing in this direction. So just so you know, in the Mediterranean, as the prevailing winds blow, they tend to circulate the waters, and there's currents that run up along the coast. So they swirl, in a sense, up here. That's really important because early sailing ships could not tack into the wind. So do you understand what I mean when I talk about tacking? So if I'm traveling and I want to go in this direction and the wind is behind me, I set my sails and the wind blows it, that's great. If I want to go, like if the wind is blowing this way and I want to go this way, I can adjust my sails to a certain degree to allow me to sort of move in that direction. At some point in time, if I want to continue to move in that direction and move more into the wind, then I have to do what's called tacking, which is moving in this direction, and then this, and then this, and then this, and this, and sort of kind of meander and make your way. Early sailing ships couldn't do this well. And I'll tell you why that's important, because this chapter has come under, in the old days anyway, it came under great attack. Oh, Paul, Luke didn't know what he was talking about. He was a terrible historian. But the more we have learned about first century sailing techniques, the more we recognize that Luke was the most incredible historian. And the accuracy of chapter 27 is absolutely remarkable. In fact, I'm going to say that it's almost mathematical precision. I won't get into the nitty-gritty of that. But I can tell you that enough scholars have done work on this chapter to know that what he describes here could only be an eyewitness. And it was only through a well-educated, trained eye that anybody could even write this document. It's just one of those brilliant pieces of literature that we can now look back upon and say, that's how they did early shipping. So when you're thinking about is this really accurate and you're reading some materials, please understand the best scholarship we have today makes this chapter out to be remarkable. Anyway, they're traveling up to Sidon. When they get to Sidon, what does Julius allow Paul to do? Go to his friends. Notice the text doesn't say that his friends came to him. He was actually allowed to leave the ship. Why is that remarkable? He's a prisoner, and he's with a prisoner of, you know, the guard who's guarding him is the top of the top, right? Why? How is it that Paul could have such grace with a one-day journey that this guard would trust Paul enough? Now, I'm not saying that Paul was, you know, free to just walk around. He likely had guards with him, but this is absolutely unheard of. And I would ask the question, why? What's Luke trying to communicate here in terms of Paul's personality and the way that Paul handles himself in amongst non-Christians? His integrity level was right at the top, and that's pretty remarkable considering how most of the world views Christianity today. In fact, pastors are at the bottom of the list, the integrity list for, you know, major occupations out there for some reason. They're sort of like down here with lawyers and some other people. It's like, oh my goodness, people don't trust pastors anymore at all. And yet Paul was able to somehow, in this short period of time, motivate this man so that he would show him great kindness. Now, I'm going to say this. You're going to see this happen over and over and over again. This great kindness is actually going to lead to all 273 of these people on this boat, or the next boat, actually living. I'll show you again what I mean when we get there, but this is a remarkable start. How does this motivate you and I to live in this world? What does it tell us about how God would have us to live here? So there's a sense there that we need to live a life that's got such integrity that people can examine it and look at it and say, looks good to me. Does this sound like Paul lived an antagonistic life towards the world? Because Christians do this all the time. We're against the world, right? Look at us. We hate everybody. He's not there. It's not how he lived. He was not one to try to pick a fight or to show the rest of the world how good he was. Even though, you know, technically he had the brain power, he was good. But this man lived such a winsome life. The world looked at him and said, I trust you. To me, brothers and sisters, that's a remarkable subplot to this story. And it's going to come back again and again and again. So I would just say this. That the world today, and I see this in Facebook all the time, looks at Christians and just says, you're useless. I guess in a sense. That's the sense that I get in media today as it examines Christianity. I think that Christianity is incredibly powerful, not just in terms of its message, but in terms of its effect. And so I would call us as men and women of God to never forget that we can be profoundly influential, even in this world. And that's where Paul was. So he made this 67-mile journey to Sidon. All right, so he stops. He's able to get refreshed because of the kindness. From there, we put out to sea again, and we passed to the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. Huh? What does that mean? All right, so I'm sitting at Sidon. I know eventually I have to make it all the way over to Rome. What's the logical path here? Yeah, I mean, that's just straight line. Why can't you do that? Pardon me?
Winds were against.
Okay, winds were against.
It's only been seen up to.
Nobody traveled in a boat in the winter here. Nobody. Ever. Boats didn't travel the Mediterranean because the storms were so bad that ships simply wouldn't make it. And so by October, November, it was almost ludicrous. In fact, it was ludicrous. Nobody would risk their boat out in the open waters. And so you get this sense that Festus really wanted to get rid of Paul. And so he ships him off at the worst possible time. And so instead of being able to go out into the Mediterranean, because this, remember, the winds were coming from the west, and that's why that they were able to make this. So as these winds blow, they form these currents. So Caesarea to Sidon, simple. 67 miles, that's a really good day's traveling for boat. So no problem there. But from Sidon onward, the only way that they could travel was to hug the coast. Why? Two reasons. As the winds blew, they would cause the waters to swirl. They would swirl up and around, so you had natural currents here that would take the boat. Further, you get land masses, and a little sciencey here, but as you well know, when the sun hits the land, it heats it up, the hot air rises, it causes actual winds to blow off of the land onto the water, and so you get another swirling effect. So in essence, the only way for them to travel was to come north of Cyprus, come around that, and come up to Myra here. A long journey. But again, you already get the sense that this is going to be a hard trip. That you've got to push through, you've got to slog through, and that's exactly what's happening here. So let's move forward. When we sailed across the open sea off the coast of Cilicia, which is up here, so they're hugging the coast, and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra at Lycia. So they landed this far, so the province of Lycia here. Again, I just want you to notice this, that they're going to now make a trip from Myra to Cnidus. And you may say to yourself, well, why would you do that? Wouldn't it just be easier to go, argh? But once again, nobody traveled in Salmon in this area during the winter. If you had to travel that far, you would not be able to get in through here because the winds would be directly against you and you wouldn't be able to tack through. And so your only hope was to come down and use this island, in a sense, as a block to the strong winds. So you would travel on the east side of this island, then hug the coast, because you didn't want to get too far out. If you got too far out, you were dead. You would hug that coast, and you would come as far as Phoenix, if you could. And that's where you would want to winter. And then it wasn't too terribly bad a journey in the spring, when things were a little bit calmer weather-wise. You cannot go through this. Nobody would travel this time of year. This is the only hope that you've got, is to hug this island here, and zip around and come through the south. So again, a really crazy route for them to have to take. So, here at Myra, by the way, they changed boats. The centurion found an Alexandria ship. So Alexandria is here. It's in Egypt. Just make note that Alexandria and Myra were two major ports in the first century. And there were boats that made this trip all the time, as you could probably imagine. So this boat was a small boat. This boat that they got on here was a massive one. In fact, it was one of the biggest boats, the grain hauling boats, that the first century culture in this land would know. We know that because of the number of people that are going to be on board it. So this boat was an Alexandrian ship. It was bound for Italy. We put us on board. But we made slow headway for many days, and we had difficulty arriving at Cnidus. So remember, 67 miles, one day, right? This one's a little bit further, 130 miles. That would be on land. To travel across here, though, is not a huge distance. And yet, it took days and days. So you get that sense that they had to fight and fight and fight. When the winds would not allow us to hold our course, in other words, we could no longer go west, we sailed to the lee of Crete. The island of Crete. The lee means over here on the eastern side of the shore, opposing Salmone. We moved along the coast with difficulty and came to a place called Fair Havens near the town of Lycia. So they made their way along this shore. They hugged it as best they could, and they end up here at Fair Havens. Much time had been lost because it had taken days and days and days. And the sailing had already become dangerous because by now it was after the fast. Any idea what the fast was? There was only one day in the Jewish calendar out of the year that they were instructed to fast. Oh, well, that's very good. Yeah, but you're right. It was the Day of Atonement, what they call today Yom Kippur. Mid-October, somewhere in there. And then again, all sailing typically was done in the Mediterranean at that point in time. Paul warned them, men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to the ship and cargo, and to our own lives also. Interestingly enough, did anybody die on this journey? No. Yeah, I don't know. We haven't got that far yet. But true. Nobody will die on this journey. Paul is not speaking here prophetically, and this is important to know. How is he speaking? In what voice is he speaking? What's he using here to make this statement? So I'm going to say this. It's not by the Spirit he's saying this. Street smarts. Human wisdom. We oftentimes discount this, brothers and sisters, in life. We oftentimes think, well, everything that I say has got to be said by the Spirit of the Lord. And I guess in a sense it can be, but I want you to see something else here. I want you to see that Christians have valuable input that's not just related to spiritual things. Paul has been a good traveler for many decades. He said he's been in at least 3 shipwrecks. We're only going to describe one of them here. Paul's been around. He knows a little bit about traveling, especially traveling by ship. And he shares that. So here's a second thing that I want to draw out of this today, and I think it's really critical and important. Christians still have good wisdom in a whole variety of different subjects that I think we need to be willing to share. And not hanging our head in shame. Paul is simply saying, listen, guys, this is not an ideal place, but we can winter here. Maybe a little hard. May even not be ideal. It may not be perfect. But we do have first century information that says that ships weathered winter here quite nicely. They could do it. And Paul is simply saying, don't go further. But the centurion, instead of listening to what Paul said, followed the advice of the pilot and the owner of the ship. Since the harbor was unsuitable to winter, that doesn't mean that you couldn't. It simply meant that it wasn't ideal. The majority decided that we should sail on, hoping to reach Phoenix and winter there. They could have walked to Phoenix, right? It's less than the journey from Caesarea here to Sidon. It looks so simple. This little extra step will bring so much peace and comfort. Really. There was a harbor in Crete facing both southwest and northwest, which is, of course, where Phoenix is right in. You can't see it on my map, but there's a nice harbor there. When a gentle south wind began to blow, they thought they had obtained what they wanted. So they weighed anchor and they sailed along the shore of Crete. So, question. You should ask yourself this. The journey from Sidon to Myra to Nidus to Fair Havens takes, 4 or 5 verses. And now all of a sudden, Luke stops and he pulls out the magnifying glass. And it's like, oh, we get this whole story about Fair Haven and making this tiny little journey be more than, 40 miles. Why? Why does Luke stop and focus on this? If I were to ask you to exegete, to draw the truth out of this passage, if I were to ask you to teach this, what would your take-home point be? What's the Spirit saying to us through Luke's writing here? Pardon me?
Take heed lest you run.
Okay, so maybe what we don't have and what we want And it looks so like it's just right there. It's so easy, and the winds are so perfect, and the day is calm, and it's just a short little jaunt, and we'll just have everything that we need there because it'll be perfect. Maybe before we strive after that perfection, that just that little extra bit, maybe God is saying to us sometimes at the fair havens in our lives, maybe the place we just need to stop. In other words, just because it looks good, and just because it looks easy, and just because the winds are just the right way, that's not necessarily God saying, go do it. We just want to be discerning. We want to have our ears open. Let me come back to politics for just a minute, because you know we're never supposed to talk about religion and politics. When you're choosing political parties, political candidates, it's really easy to look at the person that says, who's going to put the most money in my pocket? I'm going to go for him. I'm going to go for her. Sometimes God gives us a situation in which if we say nothing and do nothing, it'll be really easy for us. It's the easy way. The winds are soft and blowing. I just don't have to do anything. And yet at the same time, God's Spirit speaking deeply in our hearts and say, I want you to move. I want you to go. I want you to speak. And you're thinking, oh, that's hard. I don't want to do that. That's going to make waves. That's going to make trouble. I'm going to look bad. He looks deep in our hearts and he says, my child. It may be challenging. There's value in it. I would just encourage us today just to be thinking about what is that small, still voice saying? You'll notice in this case, who made the final decision? Pardon me? In a sense, but the centurion listened to the captain or the owner of the boat, who listened to who? Well, that's interesting terminology. So the NIV says the harbor was unsuitable to winter in. The majority decided that we would move on. So we're going to throw away the wisdom of Paul. We're going to throw away the wisdom of the boat owner, who's going to lose it all. And we're going to listen to the majority. I'm glad that William Wilberforce did not listen to the majority in England two centuries ago now, when he decided that slavery was something that should be abolished in the British Empire. I am glad that Lincoln decided that the Civil War was worth going through, even though the majority decided that slavery was okay. The majority, brothers and sisters, can sometimes be wrong. And in this case, they were. Gentle wind blowing, they weighed anchor, and they went along. So what should have been a few hour trip, maybe 3/4 of a day to a day, good winds, all of a sudden got tremendously nasty. Because before very long, which is the NIV's way of saying in a very short period of time, the wind of hurricane force, called a northeaster, swept down from the island. Island probably being up here. I'm not quite sure. Nobody's quite sure what he's talking about here in terms of the island. But you get that sense that the wind that was gentle and southerly all of a sudden turns north and easterly. So now it's blowing in this direction. Completely contrary to the way that they want to go. And even to this very day, a very well-known kind of storm. Let's see if this works. Just got a clip from a modern sailing vessel on what a storm in the Mediterranean can look like. Now, what I need you to know, this is an ocean liner. It's in the Mediterranean, and this particular picture is taken from the third floor, about 30 feet above the waterline. And I don't know if the language is all that good here, so we don't need to hear it. But let me give you just a sense of what Paul was driving through. I want to just move a little bit further along. So remember, they're 30 feet above the waterline at this point in time. And you get a sense of just how deep this boat is going to go. So those waves are at least 30 feet tall. I want you to think about what it would be like to be in this for 2 weeks. So these guys are very thankful for boats that are designed to actually go through this. But even if it... Yeah. So 30 feet, this hull, part of the hull now, is actually goes underwater at some points in time. So if I can just... What's it like to walk on a ship like that? All right, so that's enough of that stuff. You get the idea, I think, though. That's the kind of stuff that Paul had to endure in a boat that ultimately was never designed to endure that. So at this point in time, this northeasterner hits. The winds are coming down there. Where do you think, if they just let this boat go, where's this boat going to end up? Pardon me? Yeah, so they're worried about the boat actually ending up over here. And what we do know, even from this very day, is that there's sandbars here. And so if this boat gets trapped in these sandbars, it will be almost immediately destroyed because these waves will just pound over it and destroy it. And so that's what they're worried about here. And let's just look at this text. So Paul warns them, gentle winds begin to blow, they get out there, they think they're going to make it. Before long, this northeasterner sweeps down. The ship is caught by the storm, could not head into the wind, so we gave way to it and we were driven along. So in that sense, they would have aimed the boat basically into the wind as much as they could without it capsizing, but they're going to be blown basically in a southwest or in a south direction. As we pass by the lee of a small island called Caudia, so now they're traveling here, they pass through Caudia, they're moving towards this shore. We're hardly able to make the lifeboat secure, so the lifeboat typically was dragged from behind. They pulled the lifeboat onto the boat itself. When the men had hoisted it aboard, they passed ropes under the ship, so they tried to pass ropes under it. I don't know how they got them under the boat, but they did. The idea was to tie the boat up so that it wouldn't fall apart. But they were afraid of the sandbars of Sardis, which is, again, right down in this area. If they were to get caught in that, they would immediately die, and they just would not survive this storm. So they lowered the sea anchor, and they let the ship be driven along. In essence, what that means is they tried to maintain in their boat something close to pointing into the wind, but they dragged an anchor behind, which would shift the boat around and would ultimately cause the boat to start to move in this direction. It took such a violent beating that we threw the cargo overboard, right, to lighten the ship. On the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. Once the tackle is gone, you can't control the main sails anymore. But the idea was to keep the boat as light as it could and hope to float through the storm. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, the storm continued to rage. We finally gave up all hope of being saved. So again, believe it or not, we can, by the information that Luke has given here in terms of where they were,
So somewhere between the Fair Havens and Phoenix, passing by the lee, passing by the east of this, we get a sense of the direction of the wind. We get a sense of how large the boat was, knowing that there was some 273 people on board. You can sort of calculate the mass. They've done the math to say that Luke's direction, the information that he gives us, and the direction of this storm, and how this ship would have prevailed and set itself, would have actually brought it to the island of Malta in about 13 to 14 days. So about 2 weeks. So after the men had gone for a time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, "Men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourselves this damage and loss. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost." You should underline that. "Only the ship will be destroyed." Is now Paul speaking from street smarts or something else? Now it's something else. Now it's inspiration. Now it's prophetic. So in Paul's language, he mixes these. He mixes his concept of his intelligence and his wisdom with the wisdom that comes from the Spirit. And now it's very clear, nobody's going to die in this, but the boat is going to be destroyed. How do I know that? "Only the ship will be destroyed. Last night, an angel of God, whose I am, who I serve, stood beside me. He said, 'Paul, do not be afraid. You must stand trial before Caesar. And God has graciously," and I want you to underline this because this is so key. "God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island." All right. I want you to practice your hermeneutical skills again. Let's draw some truths out of this. If I were to ask you to teach on this passage, what would you come up with? What would you say? What's the point? What are our takeaways here? Okay. I don't think Paul was trying to rub it in. I do think that he was saying, "Hey, listen, I saw this." In fact, I think what he was saying is, "You guys made a mistake here. Not just that you didn't listen to me, but you didn't listen to good sense." But yes. I think in a sense, that's what Paul's saying here. He's saying, "I saw this coming. If you had listened to me, this wouldn't have happened. But now, I told you what was going to happen before, but now I'm going to tell you what's going to happen." So in a sense, it's an attestation. And I think this is what you're pointing at. Listen to me now. Hear me now. I pegged it the first time. I'm going to peg it again. And instead of rubbing it into their face, what's he do? Tell me some of the things that he does here. It's an encouragement. We're going to make this. We're going to survive this. Leadership, brothers and sisters, if I could say this. Leadership thrives when situations get difficult. I run an event at SCS every year. Well, I don't run the event. It's an auction. It's a big auction. It's a big deal. We usually raise $50,000, $60,000 at this auction every year. It is my software that actually drives the auction, and I've been doing it for, I don't know, 12 years now, I guess. One of the greatest compliments that I was ever paid was when, like, my volunteer staff, I get a different group of volunteers every year. And at the end of one of the events a couple of years ago, and sometimes things just go just sideways, right? They just go crazy. And she came up to me and she said, "I so appreciate what you've done." Said, "When everything went crazy and you had 50 people sort of grabbing at you all at once, I've never seen anybody so calm, cool, and collected before, and you just handled every problem well." And I thought to myself, wow, this is the duck thing, you know, where the duck seems on the top of the water to be doing, but underneath the water, and that's what I was doing, right? Most leaders will do that. But brothers and sisters, leadership does shine. It gives us opportunities to walk in the power of Christ and to show people around what God's doing in our hearts in the midst of these trials. And so when we're in the midst of the storms, I would just encourage you to be an encouragement. To find a way to lift those people up that are struggling around you. Because of all the people in this world, we have hope. You know, I don't know how you feel about the 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 passage. I still believe in the rapture. I'm sorry, I'm old-fashioned enough to believe that kind of stuff. But what I love about that passage is it reminds us that we do not sorrow as those that have no hope. Yeah, we sorrow. When somebody dies, we sorrow. We grieve the loss of that person, but we know that it's not forever. We have hope. And Paul brings that hope to bear in a really dark situation. 2 weeks, basically they haven't been eating. They've been facing that kind of weather. And there's no hope. They have no hope. They don't even have tackle to maneuver their boat. So even if the storm stopped, they'd be in the middle of the Mediterranean with no way to actually steer the boat or run the boat. So what hope do they have? They got nothing. How many people travel in the winter on the Mediterranean? Zero. So it's not even, well, maybe somebody will come by and save us. Nothing. And yet Paul says we're going to make it. And they're going to make it now because of the storm. Remember, no tackle means we can't run the boat. Nothing's going to push the boat. So even if the storm stopped and they're sitting here, what direction are they going to go? Back. We're out of food. They got nothing. They've already jettisoned all of the stores. And Paul rises up in this no hope situation and says, hey, wait. God spoke. So question number two. Why does God have to speak to Paul? Why does God have to speak to Paul through an angel? He already spoke to him 2 years ago and said, you're going to go to Rome, Paul.
He's discouraged too.
Sure, he's discouraged. And he doesn't know what's going to happen. I mean, is he going to be the sole survivor of this? I mean, God did promise through Christ, you are going to go to Rome. So Paul knew that. He had that. But even a prophecy 2 years old needs to be invigorated, right? It needs to be reminded. And God in his graciousness reminds Paul of that. But not just, I'm going to save you, Paul, but because of you, I'm going to save everybody.
Yeah,
absolutely. So what happens at Sidon, where he's allowed to go and visit his friends, tells you the relationship that Paul has now with the Roman. Right? He's already established the trust. But here's the thing. It's the storm that actually brings the leadership of Paul to the forefront. There is no Roman in charge here anymore, you'll notice. Well, I mean, he's there. He's technically in charge. But he's not offering hope. He's not offering any encouragement to the people. The owner of the boat has just lost it all. The sailors have no hope. And it is in the darkest moment that Paul's leadership shines. And it actually shines in such a way that all of these men are going to be saved. Prisoners and sailors. Which should lead us to a third point. That in those darkest moments, it's when God shines through us the best. And it truly shows us what he's done in our lives and in our hearts. Such a beautiful illustration of that. You should probably get a sense here of another story in the Old Testament that takes place, in essence, in the same body of water with interesting outcomes. Jonah is the story. Great storm, sailors, Jonah, and again, Jonah's sort of rising up in a leadership position, in a sense, saying, hey guys, you want the storm to end? Just throw me over. So there are some parallels. I won't spend time to derive those, but I hope you see at least a little bit of the same kind of storm. Time is flying. Okay, only got a couple minutes here to finish this up. So they have been now for 2 weeks, 476 miles. Paul prophesies that the boat is going to run aground, and it's going to run aground on an island. So that should lead us to a fourth point. Sometimes when God gives us a word, does he give us all the details? No, he doesn't. He didn't tell Paul what island. He doesn't say to Paul, well, I'm going to take you this angle. He just says, you're going to run aground somewhere. The ship is going to be destroyed. Nobody is going to die. And it's going to be on an island. So God reveals to us what he needs to reveal. And I think that's an important point maybe to draw out of this passage as well. Don't be afraid, Paul. Be strong, men. I have faith in God. So he testifies to the goodness of God. On the 14th night, I have no idea when that speech took place, but here we are, 2 weeks in, as we've been driven across the Adriatic, which is this portion of the Mediterranean here, the Adriatic. About midnight, the sailors sense that they were approaching land. How they sense that, we don't know, although there are some ideas here. I think I've got a picture. We're going to come back to that next week. Here is the likely place that Paul landed. This is the island of Malta today. As they're moving into this bay, and this is traditionally called St. Paul's Bay, we don't know for sure, but it is ironic here of what's going on. There is a land, a little bit of an isthmus that juts out into the water, and if Paul and his boat are out here, as they're moving towards this area, they would maybe not necessarily see, but they would certainly hear the breakers breaking against this portion of the land as it juts out into the water. So just a little bit of a sense of where that bay looks like today. It's quite large. What is ironic about this? This is just a little portion of it, but something unique here. And it's to the geography of the land. There are two streams of fresh water that actually feed into this bay. So I know what you're saying. Big deal. So what? Streams bring with it something. Any idea what it... I know, geological, but any idea what comes with the streams of water as they empty out into the ocean? What were you going to say? Silt, mud, clay. So what? Big deal. Actually, it is a big deal. Because as they approach this bay, they're going to drop anchor. And I can tell you from what we understand, both of first century shipping and shipping today, that to drop an anchor close to any bay like this in the midst of the storm will do nothing. Because the sandy bottom, it will not catch on anything. What makes this particular bay unique, because it's got these two streams of fresh water that flow out into the ocean, it deposits a clay that is unique to this whole area. And it's a clay that will actually hold an anchor. And will hold it fast. And it's been written about century after century as kind of unique to this particular area. Not to this island, but to this bay. They took soundings. Soundings basically meant they took a rock with a piece of rope on it and they threw it down. So this is not sonar. They took soundings and they found that they were approaching land, right? 120 feet deep. A short time later, they took soundings again, found it was 90 feet deep. Fearing that we'd be dashed against the rocks. I mean, you can see in this landscape, there are these rocks that do jut out into the ocean. Fearing that we would be dashed against these rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern. Normally, by the way, you don't anchor from the stern. You anchor from the tip, the front of the boat. But in this case, they anchored from the stern so that the winds would blow the ship around and the ship would be pointed now at the bay. Again, another one of those little technical details. The fact that these anchors actually held, nowhere else in this area would they have held except for this bay. What does that tell you as a sixth point? God's in charge. So in the book of Jonah, four times, God prepares. God prepares a wind. God prepares a storm. God prepares a fish. God prepares a fig branch. So here we go. God prepares a bay. And when the bay has to be right, it is right. But a beautiful analogy to what God can do in the midst of a storm. They drop these four anchors and they hold. In an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors let their lifeboats down from the sea into the sea, pretending that they were going to lower some anchors. Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, "Unless those men stay with the ship, you can't be saved." So the soldier cut the ropes that held the lifeboats and let them float away. Again, another one of those beautiful pictures. In order to run this boat and to get it to the best of their abilities so that they can get it close to shore, it requires everybody doing the work. So the sailors were trying to escape, thinking, we're going to get off this boat. Maybe we can make it to shore on our own. But they couldn't. So there's a unity there. Just before dawn, Paul urged them to eat. Again, encouragement. For the last 14 days, you've been in constant suspense. You've gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. You're about to have to expend a lot of energy. Not one of you will lose a single hair from his head. And after this, he took some bread. He gave thanks to God in front of them all, a testimony to God, and he began to eat. They were encouraged. They ate some food themselves. And altogether, there's 276 of us on that ship. When they'd eaten as much as they'd wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain. So whatever food stores they personally had now were chucked. They were totally committed. No food, no tackling, no lifeboats, totally committed into the hands of God. They didn't recognize the land, but they saw a bay with a sandy beach. So it's the idea. We're going to cut those four anchors, and we're going to let this boat drive into the bay. When we come back again, I got to let you go. We're going to finish up this story. But I can tell you that they're going to get close to the bay before they hit their sandbars, and the boat is just going to be destroyed from the back forward. But as the boat is destroyed, what does it produce? Wood. And that wood provides the preservers that they're going to need to make the rest of the journey to shore. And I'll tell you this, not one person's life will be forfeited. They will all make it together. So as a seventh and a final point here, just to be thinking about, there is value, brothers and sisters, in us in this journey together. Paul indicates if some of the sailors jump ship, nobody survives. But if all of us stick together, we're going to make it. Let's pray. Father, the detail that Paul gives to us, or Luke gives to us here through his observations, remarkable. And I can't imagine what it must have been like for 2 weeks. That little clip of video that we all saw here today, that lasted about 10 hours. And that storm was done. But 2 weeks. No hope. And yet, Father, you spoke. I want to pray this day for my brothers and sisters in this room, myself included. As we move into 2019 here, Lord, I don't know what each of us will face. I do know that this is a year that is going to have incredible joys, and sometimes it's going to have some incredible sorrows. It's going to have days of rest and gentle winds, and it's going to have days of storm. I want to pray this day, Father, that with that full knowledge, you would continue to build in us the power to endure, the power to see the visions and understand the dreams that you have granted to us, the stick-to-itiveness, Father, to latch on, to hang on, and to move forward to the best of our abilities, even when the going is difficult. I pray for the abilities upon our hearts, Father, to see hope, to see future, to see your hand, your potential, what you can do, what you can accomplish, how you prepare the bays of our lives with just the right clay to hang on to the anchor. God, may we see you in those moments of life where there is no tackle, there's nobody in control, it doesn't appear like anything makes sense, and yet there you are driving us to a destination. Would you build that in us today? And would you remind us in the midst of these storms that there is nothing too difficult for you? And there's going to be times that you say, peace be still, and the storm is going to be gone. And there's going to be other times that you take us through it with our face just pointed to the wind. And yet the Spirit of God still quietly behind, moving all of the details into the right place. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you that you are a God in control. I pray your blessings to be upon my brothers and sisters now, Father, and their hunger for the word. Fill them, I pray, in Christ's precious name. Amen.